Velvet Rage is one of the more popular books on gay liberation that looks at how the shame of growing up gay in a straight world can often express itself through anger, frustration, or rage.
One of the big flaws of the book, despite all the great ideas presented, is that it misses out on the intersection of gender and sexual identity, and presents traditional monogamous relationships as the ideal. Today, therapist and relationship expert Damon L. Jacobs joins us to take a look at why some gay men get angry when they're challenged, and why it's so hard to draw strength from understanding our weaknesses.
Plus, pan, vegans, and pagans, what they all have in common.
There's a new prep pill working in the corner, and she's looking to make some money, honey.
And how the Cher show musical on Broadway changed from its original run in Chicago. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of the support of fierce, fabulous people like you. Become a member and listen to 14 years of amazing podcasts at feastoffun.com/plus. Or put a tip in our tip jar and make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Thank you for your support.
Hello there.
Hi, are we talking to you via you're holding your phone up to your ear right now?
What's that?
You put us on speakerphone. Take us off of speakerphone.
Okay.
Please. Pretty
make
please.
Sure I can hear you.
Is your muscles that hold your phone up to your ear so atrophied after years of talking on speakerphone you can't hold a 8 ounce
so swishy
object to your ear?
From bending my wrist all the time, even though that certain gay therapists who write books wouldn't like me to say things like that.
What are you talking about?
The anti-femme part of the Velvet Rage.
You are down on Alan Downs's book, Velvet Rage, Overcoming the Pain of Growing Up Gay in a Straight Man's World. And it's all men, in case you're wondering otherwise.
Yeah. Now, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay, so not too much echo?
It sounds good now.
Okay.
Today, we are talking about our flaws, and that's why we're sharing with you guys, the listeners, the bugs we iron out before we tape a podcast.
Uh-huh.
When doing this podcast, sometimes our computer and our equipment malfunctions, and I get angry. I get so upset at the machine itself. And I also get upset and angry at myself. And I'm embarrassed sometimes when it's a high profile guest because they're like, oh, I thought this was a professional operation. What kind of rackety, run amok, harebrained scheme you got going on here at Feast of Funds? More like Feast of Fools, if you ask me. And I tap into my velvet rage, right? And so part of it is like, and I was reflecting on this on the book and in one chapter that Alan Downs talks about, that for a lot of queer folks, it's really, really hard to express vulnerability and to showcase your failures or your flaws.
There's certain parts of the book, the foundation of the book, that I think are really excellent. And I have had my clients read this when appropriate for the last 10 years. But there's certainly his lens by which he approaches these ideas are things that myself and many others have taken issue with. And I was trying to find an interview. I thought that he had sort of recanted some of his stuff about monogamy and his stigmatizing sexuality. And I thought he walked back on that a bit, but I couldn't find – I was trying to find that before we talked today, and I couldn't find it.
Well, how does he – in the book, for the people who haven't read it yet, how does he present monogamy?
So monogamy is the standard of normality that all gay men should – and I'm saying should in quotes – because I'm all about living without the word should, but he has a lot of shoulds. Because
you even wrote a book about it.
I did. But he really believes, or at least in The Velvet Rage, seems to indicate that that is the preferred, normal, superior way to being in a relationship, that that is the only healthy way to be in connection with others, that that is what we should be aspiring to as gay men, which we all have talked on the show many, many times, and you've talked with many guests about how flawed that idea is and how harmful that idea is.
Damon, for people who are not familiar with your work, you work as a family therapist?
So my license is marriage and family therapist in the state of New York and in the state of California. And basically that means anything related to relationships, mm-hmm. relationships that humans have with other relationships. But I also have people who talk about their relationships with their animals, especially around grief when one loses an animal. So it's really about family, however we define that term.
And in terms of like your practice and your experience, you have spent a lifetime dedicating yourself into reading a lot of the books of famous gay liberation authors and thought leaders.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that's important for me or for anyone who's in this profession is to understand how other people see health and wellness and empowerment.
Where does Velvet Rage fit into the library of pink liberation for people?
Well, it depends how you're defining liberation. I think if we're talking about liberation from the framework of being queer, campy, allowing for sexuality and abundance and kind of the radical fairy framework, the Velvet Rage falls very low on that scale. Because it really prioritizes some very traditional notions about masculinity, monogamy, and things that in the U.S. are very much consistent with white, privileged, gay male society.
And yet through the years of doing this podcast, no other book has popped up more often and been talked about as sort of the Bible for unlocking new avenues of peace and acceptance than Velvet Rage.
You mean people aren't talking about my book that way? Oh, no. My God, this is a travesty.
No, I adore your book, and I think it's super important.
And part of it, I think, you know, this is why I wanted this theme to be this of this episode, because we're dedicating a series of podcasts to Velvet Rage, is talking about flaws and the flaws in our relationships, the flaws in our lives, and even the flaws in Velvet Rage, that it's really hard to sometimes present a path for health and wellness for somebody because the first steps in that path is admitting you're wrong and that the information you're presenting could also be misleading or wrong. And that at the end of the day, we're all just have to listen to each other and come up with our own solutions. And I think in terms of what monogamy might be and why this book might be fall short on that is because when we think about the flaws, every relationship to some degree is flawed and that there is no such thing as a perfect relationship. And so when we think about the ideal relationship for each other, I think the book presents it as monogamy when it really, in your perspective, it really isn't that, is it?
I think we have seen, and you have had many guests over the years that have talked about the flaws in the structure of monogamy, and that's true for straight people as well, as gays and lesbians. That's not just a queer thing. But what monogamy often does is impose some very unrealistic standards and impositions on people about expressing their sexuality with one person. And if you're in your 20s and 30s and you're getting married today, you likely could be with the same person for 70 or 80 years, it's unrealistic to say that you're only going to have desire for one person for the next 70 or 80 years of your life. So it makes much more sense to facilitate discussions and agreements and negotiations, preferably before there's a crisis, preferably before there's a problem or a rupture in trust. And that's a lot of the work I do, and a lot of your guests like Tristan Tormino have talked about over the years, is that we're actually really trying to promote a different paradigm that helps people accelerate and feel good and pleasure in their relationships.
Because what you're saying when people are like hung up on monogamy, it's like it has to be like this, it has to be like this. And then when you say the violation is trust, then so you had a perfectly good relationship otherwise, and then that violation of trust can sometimes just end that relationship.
It certainly can, and that's what monogamy... I mean, believe me, poly has plenty of pitfalls when it comes to trust as well, but monogamy really sets people up for failure. And I see that all the time. You know, I joke with my clients. It's like, don't let this get around, because if everyone understood how to be in relationships with other people in a trusting way, I'd be out of a job. So, you know, let's, I don't want to go down to Starbucks and have to pour coffee. So let's make sure we don't let this
feel like a lot of these, you know, AIDS organizations sort of like on one side, they want to like end HIV and AIDS, and the other side, you're like, hold on a second. It sounds like then if we do end this, you'll be out of work.
That is definitely the paradox that has filtrated every agency and organization I ever worked with that related to HIV service. Was always kind of this question like, okay, we want to do this work, but we don't want to do this work. And we want a cure, but if we there was a cure, we'd all be unemployed tomorrow. So it was always this back and forth.
Well, wasn't there like in California when PrEP first started getting introduced, like so in California, especially the AIDS service organizations were like really against it?
There was really only one to be honest with you.
Yeah.
There was only one organization that I'm aware of that was really publicly steadfast against PrEP. And they clearly had a vested interest and still do in keeping the HIV epidemic raging in the U.S. and globally. And, you know, everything they've said scientifically in the last 7 years has proven to be incorrect. And they've sort of simmered down about all that. But I think that's what happens if agencies and organizations aren't really, really clear about what they're doing and why they're doing it. Mm. And it certainly does remind me where you're talking about the Velvet Rage. And I think why that book has been so successful is because the foundation of that book is so prevalent and makes so much intuitive sense for any of us. You both work in entertainment and you see this all the time. But for me, working in HIV organizations and mental health service nonprofits, the Velvet Rage is real and it is there. And you see this in meetings and you see this in emails and memos. It's this constant, like, walking on eggshells rage that I have seen. Mm. It feels like, to me, is more prevalent in gay men than in straight men or straight women.
What's the best way to kind of deal with that kind of situation? Because what happens is somebody's raging against you because they feel, from what I'm getting from this book, is they feel invalidated by what you've said, what you've done. What's a good way to kind of like extend that olive branch or just be like, hey, quit raging, you know, I want to validate you somehow?
Well, sometimes it depends on the context, of course, but I find that in a relationship or in an interaction where this is going on, it's a reminder that, okay, this person is reacting to an injury that predates me, probably by many decades. And, you know, I do imagine that little boy or that little girl who's just raging right now, who needs some attention, who needs some love, who needs understanding. So I try to go through that path and just try to say something like, I hear you're really angry right now, or I'm sorry you're so upset, or, you know, despite being upset, you're doing a really good job, or I really value you. And make that sincere, you know, a sincere acknowledgement of who they are and what their energetic contributions are in a relationship or in a work situation. But it's very hard to do that when you're on the receiving end of that rage.
Well, it also comes across as, you know, I don't hate using the term sociopathic, but, you know, as queer people, we're good at being chameleons, right? And faking it till we make it. And so when somebody comes at us angry, it's not a stretch of the imagination that we're actually very good at dealing with other people's angers to some extent. And that's why we find ourselves in service-oriented jobs, a lot of us, as waiters, as, you know, in retail and so forth.
Well, frequently we've had to do that to survive, and we've had to use our intuition and kind of a sixth sense in order to size people up. And I think that is why we're often really good as artists or service professionals or healers, is because we do often have that ability to kind of read the situation and react accordingly. I've certainly been in situations and agencies and organizations where I've been at the target and the receiving end of some intense velvet rage. And that is why I do recommend this book to a lot of my clients, because I think there's a lot in there that is helpful and instructive in terms of understanding those dynamics when they're occurring.
I find myself sometimes
triggered when somebody comes at me hot. Especially if I'm not been able to rest well the night before, if I'm hungry, if my physical needs are being met and my emotional, my financial needs are being met, it's really hard to be my best at dealing with somebody who is raging towards me. And part of it is like, and I think this is one of the flaws in Velvet Rage that a lot of people like to criticize, is that the book misses out on the intersectionality of gender and sexual identity, as well as class, race, and privilege. And and so a lot of the examples of the book are sort of drawn on sort of the financially well-off white gay male. Sorry about those ambulances. That's coming from our end over here. It's the truth ambulance, honey, coming to deliver. And part of it is like, you know, I think with Velvet Rage, it is, there is a Schadenfreude element to the book in reading all these sort of like, we call them the A-list gays, seeing how miserable and unhappy they are and how like how fucked up their lives are when the veil is lifted. That is appealing.
Well, but it's kind of like the Real Housewives of New York. Like, you have these rich, or Beverly Hills, these rich women, and they're like, they still have these horrible problems.
And I think that's part of the appeal of the book and why it's gone around so much, because it is, you know, Barry was the CEO of a Fortune 500. Man, hold on a second. There's like a...
There's something going on.
The popo is going down outside our studios here. We might get arrested.
Is Jesse out of jail?
Shit.
Jesse Smollett.
Yeah, they confused our dog with Jesse Smollett with Jesse.
Now he's up and he's wolf, like, what wolf. Do you guys want? He's looking at us.
So it, part of it is like with Velvet Rage is it's hard for the book good ideas of being overwhelmed by shame, compensating for shame, cultivating authenticity, and getting onto the road of happiness. It gets lost because it doesn't understand that, you know, there are many trans people, for example, who are gay, and some gay people are assigned male at birth, and later come out as trans women. And so by the author's intention of only focusing on cisgendered, well-off, high-profile gay, usually Caucasian clients, it misses the boat on that message. And in some ways, the book itself and the author himself falls trap to this fear of flaws, right? And that's at the core of it, is when we're dealing with somebody who's raging because they're overwhelmed by shame, it's usually tied to some type of flaw being brought up.
Right. I completely agree. And we don't make room, as gay men, as this theory goes, we don't make room for being flawed or making mistakes, because that was intolerable when we were trying to survive at an early developmental age. A lot of us internalize this sense of being different, i.e. bad or wrong, at such an early age, perhaps before we even understood language or sexuality in any way. But we got that message directly. And it meant that we have to be, if we're going to survive, we have to be perfect. We have to be exceptional. We have to be outstanding in anything we do. And that is, as this theory goes, is often why we do excel in our lives as adults, because we are driven harder than our straight counterparts. But that comes with a price tag, and it does come with this pressure, and it does come with a short fuse, and it does come with a very limited ability to acknowledge that, hey, I screwed up, or I made a mistake, or I didn't say the right thing, or, you know, I changed my opinion. I had an opinion, and then I learned more information, and I evolved. We don't really make room for that, especially as gay men.
Yeah, I noticed that when I'm, like, telling people about my interest and passions in bodybuilding and in drag, and combining those two in some degree, it feels like I'm an imposter. I'm betraying somebody or somehow. And in some ways that I'm being happy that I'm flawed, that I'm not able to, you know, and we think about like the jack of all trades concept that comes from the book, that as compensating for shame, but there's not a lot of discussion that about how your wide variety of interests, which I think is always healthy, and I think actually to be admired. We're not talking about how others see you as incomplete because you're interested in things that sometimes can come into conflict with each other, especially when it comes to like gender expression. And mm-hmm. I think in some ways, you know, the next stage of Velvet Rage for gay people or queer people's liberation is really understanding and valuing the struggle of trans people, because the struggle of trans people is blurring those lines of gender expression.
Well, yes, I think we need to understand that there's a reason why the T is in LGBT, even though a lot of people and places forget that. And I agree. This is it's an area where I'm learning and I mm-hmm. don't know a lot. And there's a lot that has changed just in the last 5 years that I don't know about, but I'm willing to say, I don't know. I'm not going to say like, oh, you know, it's your fault if I am ignorant about something. You know, I'm not going to rage at other people because I don't understand something. I try to really understand and learn or read what other people who are in that situation are speaking about, so I can have a better understanding and accept that if I do go about trying to help, I'm going to make mistakes.
Is it hard to determine what you want in a relationship or even what you want out of life if you're a person who is interested in this wide variety of topics or even people, right? So like as queer people, compensating for shame means that we become interested in a wide variety of jobs and passions and hobbies, but also this reflects itself in our friendships. So if we're healthy, if we're going to be self-actualized, we're going to have a wide variety of friends of all ages, backgrounds, identities. And conversely, our sexual relationships are going to mirror that, too.
But I don't think that in and of itself is problematic. I think it's more like the reasons why. And this is, again, where I do take issue with Dr. Downs in this book, because he really stigmatizes and frowns upon having multiple sexual partners, anonymous sex partners. He seems to perceive that as a deficit. And I believe quite the opposite. I think that sexuality is beautiful. I think sexuality is healthy. I think sexuality with multiple partners can be an experience that's really enriching and empowering and joyful and celebratory. But I do agree that people can go about that in a really unhealthy way that causes them more harm, that causes them to feel more separated than connected. And then that might be a problem. But I don't assume that's a problem, that just because people love having sex with a lot of different people and maybe it's anonymous and maybe not, especially in the age of PrEP and U equals U, these are healthy, celebratory human experiences that a lot of us are getting to have now for the very first time in our lives. Mm-hmm. And I really respect and honor the people that are searching that out in these really healthy ways.
Do you think his mindset is through the lens of HIV and AIDS?
It was definitely written at a time when HIV and AIDS was a lot more deadly than it is now. I think he wrote this in the late 90s or the early 2000s. Mm. And, you know, there was certainly the toll HIV took on the body was a lot stronger then. But there was still plenty of sex to go around. There was still plenty of group sex, anonymous sex. I mean, that was happening. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's necessarily, you know, I know for me that I was having plenty of sex in that time and it didn't feel and still doesn't feel to me like that was ever an unhealthy thing. I tell my clients who are struggling, it's like, we just want to be really aware. Are we using sex for validation or celebration? And if you're using it for validation or trying to use it to fill a hole, metaphorically, not literally, but you know, if you're trying to use it to distract yourself from emptiness mm-hmm. or from who you really are, then it might be problematic.
Well, how do you know the difference? How do you know the difference?
Because of generally how you feel afterwards. Because if you're having a lot of sex and you end up feeling lonely, alienated, isolated, and separated from your community and from your peers, then that might be a problem. If you feel guilty afterwards, if you feel rotten afterwards, that might be a problem. Mm. If you come away from these sexual encounters feeling love and connection and empowerment and fun and play and naughtiness and, you know, all these really great things, then that's a sign that you're doing it for healthy reasons.
Part of me is like, you know, when I started growing out my beard and stopped dyeing my hair blue, women would stop me on the street and flirt with me, and I didn't grasp that. And when I finally dawned on me, I said, oh, let's have some babies together. And part of it is like, I think my natural reaction to connecting with people is always like, you know, a stranger's a friend I haven't met, but a friend is a long-term partner that I've never met yet. And mm-hmm. it's easy for me to like develop long-term relationships with people in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the people, it really unnerves them. Mark says this all the time. It's like, sometimes you give people like compliments that are too intense for them.
They're too intense. They can't accept them. Fausto had a friend and he would say these things to him. And the guy's like, Fausto, nobody talks like this. Nobody says these things to people. Why are you doing this? And he's like, I just paid you a compliment. That's all.
But I imagine that Mr. Rogers has the same problem too.
Not anymore. Well,
and Fausto, what's interesting is if you were insulting people, they'd probably more be accustomed to that. Mm. Right?
Well, it's a shade. Like, that's mm-hmm. why like people are people actually take workshops on delivering shade, but there's really little interest in workshops on like loving or complimenting somebody or, you know, or celebrating their uniqueness.
Right. So I really appreciate that you're going against the grain by giving authentic acknowledgement and compliment to people in your life. I think if more people did that, we would have less need for Velvet Rage and probably less need for my counseling services.
So hate more and make Damon L. Jacobs rich.
Yes, exactly.
Mark and I run across people that are they identify as pan, vegan, or a combination of the two, pagan. Is that, am I getting that right?
What?
Pan, vegan combined is pagan, right?
Sure.
But, you know, when people are sort of like have an unconventional relationship or a diet that is part of their identity, and it's not just like, I prefer vanilla ice cream, but they're like, I'm a vanilla ice mm-hmm. cream person. You know, there's a difference between a preference and an identity. And these individuals usually come across as defensive. They're marginalized people usually who are trying to express control on their environment. And in our experience with the Radical Fairies, for example, we've run across some people who are pan vegan pagans who struck me as very rigid and inflexible and easily triggered by any kind of lighthearted commentary. And even me making this joke that pan and vegan is pagan is probably upsetting some people who are listening to the show right now. And I mean, no disrespect.
You're attacking their identity.
Well, I'm not that.
I'm sorry. You're invalidating it.
Am right? I invalidating by saying those three words sound similar to each other and that they usually come together in when a person introduces themselves? Like, you know more about their what they had for lunch than, you know, what city they were born in.
I agree. I mean, and I absolutely feel like I've seen the same thing. I'm going to quote you, but I'm going to say it because I'm saying it because I don't want to get you in trouble. But one of the things I've said is that the Radical Fairies are neither. And I know you've said that before, too.
I never said that.
Yeah, I think there's a few podcasts back.
I may have said it in joking, but I didn't mean it.
But this idea, because they claim to be, not, I'm not saying everybody, this is not, I'm being very stereotypical here,
sure.
So I'm not saying everybody.
Go ahead, paint with those broad brushes.
Some people who are active in the group are often claimed to be very open and spiritual and loving, but their interactions with other people are exactly opposite of that. They're rigid. They're inflexible. They can't tolerate different ideas. They won't tolerate diversity in terms of sexuality, in terms of food. I mean, in terms of dress, they just like they're rigid and inflexible. They're kind of like the exact mirror opposite of the Tea Party on the right. Mm. And there's an exceptionalism on the left, particularly in the Bay Area of California, that really clings to this victimhood. And if you try to go there, or if you try to talk about that, or you try to joke about that, you get this Velvet Rage intensity leveraged against you. And it's mean. And I saw that a lot when I lived there. I lived there for 10 years. And it was like, dang, this is really angry and it's really intense.
But these people's anger stems from being sort of marginalized to in their lives.
Invalidated.
Whereas if you bring up, you know, if you challenge or joke around someone who watches Fox News a lot or a religious fundamentalist, they're part of the power structure. They are setting policies. They're driving this planet into it off the cliff, you know, environmental cliff. Mm-hmm. And they're in some ways very easily triggered as well. So what's the mechanism behind somebody who's like a right-wing fundamentalist Fox News viewer getting upset because you were joking about something, as opposed to someone who is progressive and alternative?
Well, and both of those extremes to me really speak to this part of humans that is often at operation. And to me, this speaks to the shoulds. Because the further you get on the right and the further you get on the left, the more shoulds you get. And shoulds are rigid and inflexible ideas about how I should be, how you should be, how the world should be, how the weather should be. That once you get into the realm of shoulds, all you have is rage. Because generally, the reality of the situation or the person is going to conflict with how you think they should be or how they should be eating or dressing or acting, etc. So the further you go with shoulds, the more rage and intolerance you're going to have. And I think what we're seeing in our society on both ends of this continuum is a lot of attention and energy being driven in these polar rigid directions.
When you talk about shoulds, you're saying like setting expectations for yourself that are not of your own making, that you're feeling like you're having to meet somebody else's expectations.
Yeah, rigid and inflexible ideas that aren't open to change, aren't open to learning, that just dismiss another person's complete experience. And again, I'm talking about the right and the left on this one. That this is where I see that. I love that this show, Feast of Fun, really gives people different voices to different guests and gives them a platform to say, we may agree, we may not agree, but, you know, we can all still respect each other while we're having these discussions. And I like that very much. That's why I listen to this all the time.
What do you make of people who are always fighting with other people that they're their own community on hookup apps? And then they screenshot this stuff and call them out on social media. Especially, one thing that really unnerves me is like seeing like people who are in their early 20s reacting to anybody they see as older as the trigger word they use is creep, creepy, creeping around. And it's really, to me, it's very sad because a lot of, you know, the most enriching relationships I had in my early 20s were with people who are over the age of 30.
Oh, yeah.
And not to prescribe what the liberation or path for another person may be, because everybody's path is unique. But when you're bragging about how you told this old, in quotations, old man off, who was just, you know, wanting to hook up for sex with you or inviting you to a party and, you know, just trying to like desperately trying to connect with you because they were interested in your youthful energy, your good looks or
your
whatever,
big cock.
Your big hard
delicious
cock.
Booty, your ripped abs.
How can we
your stunning intellect
bridge an age? I feel like this age gap, especially when I hear like, and I usually, of course, I'm, you know, over the age of 40, so I'm hearing it more now from young people, and sometimes even directed at me, is, you know, like creepers. Oh, they were so gross. They were extra. They were, you know, gross. And part of it is like that person was just like expressing interest and they said no and that was the end of it.
Well, yeah, the ageism in our society and specifically in the gay community is there. It's palpable and it's always been there. I've never really understood it because I've always eroticized older men. So I was that guy in the club when I was 19 or 20 that was going after 40-year-olds.
So you always got laid.
I've always eroticized older men, and I've always seen not just at the sexual value, mm-hmm. but as you're saying, the intellectual value, the emotional value, the experiential value in forming relationships with people of all ages. But that's not the case for everybody. We're not going to be immune to ageism. And if somebody's I know people do this in social media. People do this in my Facebook group, the Prep Facts group, where we talk about prep all the time. But people will post these screenshots of an experience they had where someone stigmatized them or called them a slut or something bad because they're using prep. And I just don't get it, because that would be, I would never think to do that for myself. I would never think to share something like that publicly. I don't understand what the purpose is. Well, I mean, I understand they're sometimes trying to get attention mm-hmm. or support or validation when their feelings got hurt. I don't understand why people do this out of a sense of viciousness, unless that's generally who they are and they're mean and their intentions are to try to hurt other people, which we could probably, again, go back to the Velvet Rage and say, well, that happened to you at some point and now you feel like you have to do it to others, that the abused person becomes the abuser. And I do feel like social media lends a lot of audience to that kind of discussion, as opposed to the kind of things we talk about trying to build community and respect and empathy and compassion for people of all ages, of all genders, of all racial backgrounds. We could have this great conversation here, but, you know, this will not get as many clicks as a conversation that's going to talk about something hateful.
And part of it is like, that's why we're listener supported and not advertiser driven. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we're more than welcome to take advertising dollars, but part of it is like, if you want this kind of content to exist, it has to be listener supported programming, which reminds me to, you know, if you want to come out of the closet and become a Feast of Fun supporter, now is a great time to do so. Go to feastoffun.com/plus and ensure this podcast is around for other people to listen to.
Yeah. If you don't want to have fun, be a fun supporter.
That's right.
Does that work? Okay.
What about Peter Pan syndrome? My mother actually said that I had Peter Pan syndrome when I was a kid, that I never really wanted to grow up. And I always thought that was like really a terrible thing to tell your children who are in the process of growing up. You know, like, hey, snap out of it. Be responsible. Because I actually was a very responsible child. And like, I even ran like a small business in high school making tie-dye T-shirts, you know, and to me, it's like it's this idea. But I do see this, you know, particularly like the CEO of Abercrombie and Fitch, who had a lot of dysfunctional relationships with his employees, with his friends and family and loved ones, where it stemmed from their anger, their frustration, their pain of aging. And mm-hmm. wanting to see the beauty in the wrinkles in their face, so they get plastic surgery and Botox to the point they look kind of frozen and you know, unnerving to look at their faces. People calling themselves boys when, you know, it especially in the light, you know, of sort of the, you know, it just seems unsavory to me, and I'm not sure how to talk about this. Like the other side, you know, when you're getting older, is it being comfortable in the aging and being sexually active?
Mm-hmm. I know what you're saying, and I'm troubled by the same sorts of things. I had a colleague when I was doing vaccine research here in New York City, who at the time was in his early 20s, and he was already starting to get Botox and talking about surgery. And he's just such a beautiful young person, and he just didn't see himself that way when he looked in the mirror. Mm-hmm. So it shows that he had, you know, a distorted perception of himself, and really felt so much shame about being a human being with potential for wrinkles. Yeah, I was going to say with wrinkles, but he didn't even have any yet. He was just so terrified of them. And we would have conversations about it. And he was a very smart guy. He was very intelligent, but he still held on to this distorted image of being ugly or flawed, back to this idea of flaws, because he was getting to be in his mid late 20s and possibly could look less than what he was calling perfect. We would talk about this, and that discussion wouldn't really make a difference. Fausto, I think the only thing that we have the ability to do is what you and Mark are already doing, which is to be the role models that you are. And I'm very conscientious that when I talk about PrEP or do anything in public, it's clear I'm 47 years old. I do have wrinkles. I do have gray hair. And I am so grateful to still be alive and have survived the AIDS crisis, as well as some individual crises that I've been through. Mm. And I think that's all we can do is just demonstrate with our actions that we can get older and still feel empowered and joyful and celebratory and playful and have fun and still have sex and humor and be productive members of society. And I think our actions teach that a lot more than our words do.
What about coming out as poly, or do we even need that as a word? We just, you know, because part of it
people like to identify as that. Sure. Well, poly means that they're having more than one relationship, right?
But I would go crazy if there was somebody else other than Mark in my life, you know? And believe me, some people have tried. And I'm just like, I feel like sometimes I'm like, it's kind of like my mother says, it's like, don't feed that cat because otherwise it's going to be hanging around.
So you gotta, and that's why Foster has stayed away from pussy.
Well, and again, I believe that people have a right to have whatever kind of relationships or families that are right for them, as long as everyone's in agreement and consenting and everyone's approaching this from a place of respect and integrity for one another. And if they're making agreements, that they stick to those agreements consistently. That is not, you know, having more than one partner is not right for a lot of people. But I do think that we're going to see at some point in the next 20 to 30 years, because of when I talk with people in their 20s and 30s about this, I do think we're going to see a shift in where we are culturally in terms of accepting these kind of arrangements a little more. I think right now it's still very confusing and often stigmatizing for couples or truples or more than who do enter into agreements as a larger family unit. A lot of people just don't get it or are afraid of it. And I think that will be shifting over this next few decades that are coming up.
When we were fighting for marriage equality, a lot of right wingers were saying, you know, if we make marriage equality happen, the next slippery slope is polygamy.
And animals.
And animals.
Oof. Well, I think important to remember, if they were to say that, is key to marriage equality of any kind is consent. So, you know, polygamy is about a man who can marry multiple wives, but they can't have another partner either. So that's not consensual, right?
Well,
that's about patriarchy.
So you're not arguing for like a Mormon's construct of a multi-partner relationship. You're talking about something else altogether.
Right. No. Polygamy is inequitable. It's about men, not women. It's saying men can do things that women are not allowed to do. So I don't agree with that kind of thing.
What is it when Mae West, she was a polyandrist, right? She had a lot of men in her life.
Yeah.
Well, why not?
And so like, what word are you using to describe all this poly romantic or
Either polyamorous or open or creating a family with multi partners? You know,
how does that fit into the law of marriage equality? Like, are we going to, you know, how does that even work?
Well, marriage equality to me is a legal term. It's not an emotional term.
Sure.
It's a legal thing. And I do believe in the right for us to have legal protections and medical and financial protections. So I'm all for that as a choice. But that doesn't always fully convey or illustrate one's emotional commitments.
And part of it is like when we're really talking about marriage equality, we're talking about three things: who can visit you at the hospital, how you're paying your taxes, and what kind of health care you're getting. And so in terms of, like, you know, our society, we've seen in our generation a huge theft of wealth from the middle class into the upper classes. And we've seen a kicking the ball down the road in terms of healthcare reform. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it is interesting how, like, the struggle for equality gets defined by the very people who are trying to deny it to us. Right. And so we need to define equality as the ability for everybody to have access to health care and for, in terms of taxes, to be given to, you know, tax the corporations and the wealthy that are they're getting away with it. We, like, when I was born, corporations and the wealthy were charged a marginal tax rate of 70%, meaning any amount they made over, I think it's like 70, any amount that they made over what everybody else was making, they had to pay 70% of.
Mm-hmm.
which was, you know, so if you were a multi-billionaire, anything about the rest of that stuff, you would have to then contribute. And as a consequence, through our lifetimes, we've had to make up that difference.
Yeah.
And so, you know, then, and these people have defined that as like, oh, well, if we have marriage equality, then, you know, who's going to be paying taxes if everybody's, you know, in a polyamorous relationship? You know? And I'm like, bitch, you are. You're supposed to pay your marginal tax rate 70%. Let's move on to talk about Cher.
Damon, you came to Chicago last year, and you were so gracious to take us to the Cher show. They started it here in Chicago. And for those people who don't know, it's the story of Cher's life told in a Broadway musical. And it was focused on her and her TV show that she had at the time, the Cher show. So it was a lot of her putting on this production of the TV show, but examining her past life, you know, her growing up as a kid, meeting Sonny, and then putting on the show together, and then, you know, becoming her own woman.
Turning back time. She sings that at the beginning of the show, right?
So not anymore.
And so it opened here in Chicago, and then, as we know, like here in Chicago, they do a lot of pre-shows here, but what ends up on Broadway can sometimes be markedly different because they're like, this worked, this didn't work, this didn't work. And so you saw both versions. You saw the Chicago version, and now you most recently saw the New York version. What's the difference?
So there were a lot of differences, most of which were improvements, but there was one thing that I thought was really not a good improvement. So I'll tell you what worked first.
Okay.
When we saw this in Chicago, the whole premise established in the first 5 minutes, the whole narrative was that someone was doing a show about Cher's life. So she needed to show us about her life. So we were watching from the audience, a show within a show, kind of then within a show, once they do the Sonny and Cher show. And it was really confusing. And they kind of dropped that whole narrative by the end of Act One, and we never heard about it again. So it didn't really make any sense whatsoever. That's gone. That's totally gone. There's no mention of that at all in the Broadway version. So that's an improvement. That's definitely an upgrade. The narrative is clearer. It's more now, there's more interactions between the three Chers, talking about their life, reflecting on their life. I think that works better.
Oh, yeah. For the listeners that don't know, is like they had a young version Cher, a middle-aged version Cher, and then, well, no. A young version, a younger, and then they kind of stop at middle age, right?
Right. '80s Cher is played by Stephanie Block, and she is phenomenal, and she really got the crux of the good reviews in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So her role has been expanded in the Broadway version.
And we call her the Nadia Ginsburg Cher.
Exactly.
She's the Cher when, if you're going to impersonate Cher, she's the one you pick.
She has the kinky hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has the energy. She has the vocal tone. She has the speech intonations. She's so good. Mm-hmm. And she plays a much larger role in the narrative now in Act One than she did, than I recall she did in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all an improvement.
I heard a rumor that they added a skeleton to represent Cher in the future.
No, they didn't see that.
And that she gets into a wrestling match with her younger self.
They didn't quite go there. No, they didn't do that.
So it's an improvement at seeing the.
It's an improvement.
Yeah.
And there is a whole segment now in the new version that includes the infomercial, the hair care product she did, which is usually Cher doesn't ever talk about this in real life. It's something she doesn't ever want to discuss, but she obviously gave her approval because it is now a segment in the regular show. And they explain that she did this series of infomercials in 91 and 92 because she was out of money, because she hadn't worked for 2 years, because she was sick and had chronic fatigue syndrome, and no one in Hollywood would hire a woman over 40 then anyway. So she wasn't working at all, and she needed the money, and that's why she did the infomercials. So they added all of that.
I watched a little bit of the infomercial the other day. So it's her and her sister and somebody else, I don't know, and they're talking to this woman who's a hair specialist. They're like, oh, look at this amazing hairspray that we have. And how they got a half an hour of material out of this, I don't know. but I'm glad she got the coin. That's probably around the same time that she made the commercial for a gym here in Chicago. She made
She was the spokesperson for what is it? The fitness club. Mm-hmm. Shoot, I'm blanking out, but it became Bally's Total Fitness, mm-hmm. and then later Chicago Health Spas.
Was she on the elliptical and
she was doing, was she doing her inner? She was working her inner thighs mm-hmm. in part of the exercise. We call it the vagina tightening exercise. And it was just really kinky and weird and sort of fetishy. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was a very unusual commercial to see. And it inspired a lot of women, actually, and inspired the 80s aerobics movement. So Olivia Newton-John was kind of part of that whole thing, was with her video Physical. And yeah. Jamie Lee Curtis and John Travolta in the film
Perfect.
Those were
definitely 80s. When did the Cher commercial come out? I thought that was the
90s. She was in the 80s.
I thought it was the 90s.
Well, so the Cher, yeah. the fitness stuff didn't get stigmatized because you're right. So many other people had done it. And Jane Fonda mm-hmm. had kind of paved the path.
In 1988 and 85.
Serious celebrities could talk about fitness in that time. So Cher wasn't really penalized for that. What she did get penalized for and couldn't get a job for years after that was the infomercial, because people really looked down upon this late night 30-minute hair care commercial, during which, by the time, she's wearing a wig the whole time anyway. So that's another whole problem.
It's right somebody's there. Hair, okay?
It was somebody's hair, but it sure wasn't hers.
She paid for it.
they included that, and I'm glad. Now, there's one thing they did at the end that I don't like, and if anyone is going to see it or, you know, you're this is not a huge spoiler alert, but there is a spoiler alert here. When we saw this in Chicago, mm-hmm. she rises to the top again with her single Believe, and then the show ends with her disco hit, Take Me Home. And she kind of realizes that her true self, her spirit, her soul is really within her. And her mother gives her advice to just go home and that she has the truth within her. So she does. And then she gets a little dance with each of the three men who are illustrated in the play. She gets a dance with Greg Allman, with Rob, and then she gets a dance with Sonny. And I absolutely just broke down and cried because I thought that last minute that she had to dance with Sonny Bono, who is long since dead in real life, was a very special moment. I thought it was beautiful. And the play ended on that in Chicago. All of that is gone in the New York version. They don't do any of that. It's all gone. They just end where she gets popular again and she sings Believe and that's it. And I thought that was that's a loss for the show not to have that at the end.
That's too bad. You know, I always hate it when they like take out the things you like about a show.
Yeah, I think I don't know exactly their logic for that. I mean, I think they just wanted to end it. They were trying to go in chronological order or something. But that those moments that she gets to say goodbye to each of the three men were very, very touching and really, I think, summed up the whole play very well. And none of that is happening now. So if anyone's listening from the show as a viewer, to me, that was emotionally a disappointment as far as the narrative go. But everything else, I think they improved.
Well, with these Broadway musicals, you know, especially they're based on material that we're familiar with, they sometimes mm-hmm. come across as sort of these, it's like when Fox did the live Rocky Horror musical.
Yeah.
It just feels like they're messing up a classic.
Yeah, that Fox thing was just...
And they don't have anything good about what the original source material was in the first place, and you're just, like, left empty-handed, and you feel like you wasted your time.
Yeah. But what I think the show does, as it did in Chicago, is to celebrate this icon, and not only because she's an icon, but because she is such an accomplished artist, human, and they really show that she is often very insecure, very afraid, and puts on this brave front, not unlike what we're talking about with the Velvet Rage. Mm. She's always been driven to accomplish. She's always been driven to perform, to put on this sort of illusion of this tough, invincible person. But underneath that is someone who is often very afraid and insecure and you know, uncertain about her role in the world. And I love that they really show that. And, you know, that Cher, the real Cher, is now 72 and still touring. And I think her voice now sounds better than it ever has. Mm. And I think that all of that is a very inspiring thing for us to see and witness, not only the celebration of this person in a Broadway show, but that in real life, she's still out there kicking and dancing and singing at the age of 72. And if that's another way to combat the ageism that we were talking about earlier, I think Cher and Dolly Parton are really at the forefront of that in terms of their creative work into well into their 70s.
I just saw Cher in concert. She came here to the United Center, and it was so much fun because I'd never seen her live before. You know, you took us to the Broadway musical, but it was such a treat to see her and have her, you know, she spent a good portion of the show just talking to the audience about her life and her career and how many times that she has just been so desperate and down and out. And she said, you know, she didn't like David Letterman. She didn't want to do David Letterman's show. And they're like, what's it going to take? And she's just like, $28,000, because she'd gotten a bill. And she goes, I got a bill for $28,000. I had no money. And so I was just like, I'll do it for $28,000. And just like, we don't do that. And so she's like, well, you have your answer. Then there you go. And eventually they just said, okay, we'll pay you $28,000. And so she showed up to do it.
Ooh, that's a big T, because you're not supposed to do those things.
And what I didn't realize either is that, like, how inspired, and now I see it, of course, is like how inspired she was by Elvis. Her mother took her to see Elvis as a young child. And so you can kind of see, like, her swagger, you know, that she has is very Elvis inspired.
Definitely. She actually does some Elvis drag in one of her videos.
Yeah.
I think the Walking in Memphis video from 96, she does her Elvis impersonation there. So I think, you know, these even though we do live in a world where there's rage and there's intolerance and it seems sometimes on social media that people are getting further away from the kind of values of the world that I'd like to live in, I'm reminded that there's a lot of examples of some very loving, inspirational, abundant energy of that just sparks creativity and compassion in others. And I think there's so much of that in the world, too. Mm-hmm. And I always try to hold on to that balance.
Well, Cher is very inspirational. I think she's especially inspirational to Britney Spears' team, because now they're making a Broadway show, which will debut here in Chicago, called Once Upon a One More Time. And they're going to use, I think it's 26 songs of Britney Spears to create a musical, like in a fairy place, magical land.
And I heard rumors that there's going to be 26 different Britney Spears, with one of them being the shaved head one with the umbrella. And she comes into the audience and attacks the patrons.
Or 23 Britney songs. There's going to be one, too, that comes out of a limo and her bald vajayjay is going to flash the audience. You know, but, you know, I mean, what Cher means to us is, like, for a lot of, like, the young, well, not so much young, like the 30, 40-year-old olds and stuff like that now, is like, that was their Britney, you know, they grew up watching
that.
Her so
man, I feel so sorry for people who feel that Britney Spears is your Cher, because I have to say Britney Spears is no Cher.
Well, Cher, there's only one Cher.
Well, part of it is like Britney Spears is not somebody who's has the emotional or even intellectual wisdom of somebody like Cher, and I don't know if, like, you know, that's part of the reason I'm gravitated. I'm glad we're starting to see more female entertainers with that same kind of intelligence. Because for a while, it just felt every female pop star was just this empty shell of a person.
I get that people like 10 years, like people in their 30s grew up with Britney and they feel they've been part of her life. And so they do have that symbiotic connection that I have with like Madonna or Cher or Dolly or Olivia. You know, they have that with her. So I get that and I respect that. I don't think she's that interesting as an artist. And I don't think she's a great singer, but she definitely has surrounded herself with some good producers and has some good songs. But as a person, I don't find her all that interesting. And honestly, I think the only thing interesting about her is that she did have a very public meltdown, and I'm not sure how she addresses that these days, but I think there's sort of an area where she can maybe teach or inspire people to, you know, stay in there even when they're feeling bad or going through a crisis. But I guess, you know, this is the part of getting older. I don't get these kids, but there are other people like Pink or Beyonce who I think are fascinating. And I think they're the ones who really have the talent and the spirit and the grit to, you know, we're going to see them 50 years from now, I hope.
You don't think Iggy Azalea is a paradigm of virtue?
Okay. I don't think so.
With PrEP, we have seen dramatic decreases in new HIV infections. And yeah. to the point that some HIV service organizations are announcing that they want to have a goal of zero new infections. And alongside Gilead, that produces Truvada, the medication, has been cashing in big. But... Yep. They're saying that they now have the data to be transitioning patients over to Descovy, a drug with a longer patient life. Mm-hmm. What does this mean exactly? What is Descovy?
Okay, so it's actually Descovy.
Descovy.
Yeah.
Not Discovery, the new Star Trek series.
No.
Not like that. No, it's called Descovy. And metabolically, Descovy is very, very similar to Truvada. The difference being is the way the drug is deposited in your kidneys. Mm. It's less – I mean, Truvada is not that hard on the kidneys for an otherwise healthy person, but it does – you know, it does make the kidneys work a bit, mm-hmm. as well as could affect bone density. And Descovy is known for not having those side effects, or if they do, it's only a fraction of the side effects that Truvada would cause. So it's safer on the bones. It's safer on the kidneys. And so my understanding is that Gilead were like, okay, so we have this drug. It was approved for HIV treatment by the FDA. So can't we use this for PrEP as well, for prevention? Mm-hmm. And the FDA said, no, you actually have to have evidence or data to verify that this drug would work as well as Truvada for PrEP in order for us to approve this. So Gilead went in and did a study, and there was a lot of controversy behind it, but they did it. And the results of the study that were revealed about a week and a half ago showed that it is comparable to Truvada, that mm-hmm. it is just as effective. Now, this is only one study, but they had 5,000 participants, I think, and 2,500 took Truvada, 2,500 took Descovy. And again, Descovy was comparable to Truvada in terms of efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that at some point, it is likely the FDA will go ahead and approve this to be used for PrEP. And then those of us that are using PrEP to remain HIV negative while we're still having all that nasty anonymous sex that Alan Downs doesn't want us to have, that we will have this extra pill to protect ourselves from HIV if we choose to use this. Now, the controversy or some of the criticism around this is that Descovy is a newer drug, and that means that it's going to stay on patent, that its ingredients are protected in the United States longer than Truvada. Truvada is estimated to be going off patent, meaning in the US to go into generic form, which is a lot less money for the company. That's expected to happen in 2021. Descovy is a new drug, so we don't really know. It's just the patent could go on, I don't know, for a very, very, very long time. So that's sort of the controversy and the criticism is like this drug doesn't it does work for PrEP. It doesn't significantly change the side effects because the side effects are not significant to begin with. Mm-hmm. So what it appears to be in the eyes of some critics is just a ploy by Gilead to make more money and keep a drug on patent longer.
Mm.
Well, don't be throwing no shade. Gilead just wants to get paid.
So what they might happen is they might, you know, stop production of it and be like, we don't make enough money off of Truvada anymore. So we're focusing on Descovy. So we pay up, suckers.
And I have been told that there is no discussion or consideration of discontinuing Truvada at any time because mm-hmm. a lot of people still use it for treatment. Mm-hmm. And that was its original intention, was mm-hmm. to be used to save people's lives living with HIV. And it's still commonly used for that. Mm-hmm. So there's no plan or intention that I'm aware of to mm-hmm. discontinue Truvada anytime soon.
Do you think Alan Downs is on PrEP?
I thought he was... I thought I could be wrong, so I'm sorry if I'm wrong, but I thought he was living with HIV. I thought he came out.
Oh, that's right.
I'm
like blanking out on that. Yeah.
That's not your business anyway.
It's not my business.
So, well, but he was public. No, he did talk about that publicly. Okay. So it's you know, that's not a secret.
It's part of his revised version of his book, mm-hmm. the second edition.
Yeah, I don't know how he feels about PrEP. My hope is that he has understood how this drug works and how medically, sexually, and spiritually it is such a beautiful change that allows us to celebrate our bodies and many other people's bodies. And I would hope he would see it that way. But based on... the Velvet Rage, I'm not so sure he does.
It's part of like the last presidential election that got Trump into the White House. We saw a schism inside queer liberation and politics, where you had somebody, you know, people were sort of describing this as social Democrats and neoliberals butting heads with each other. And the idea is that you had sort of this old school, the old money, people like Alan Downs versus like the younger people who are more intersectionality, and supporting Bernie Sanders as opposed to Hillary Clinton. You know, and part of it is like, you know, this schism that does exist in our community is hurting us, and it's disenfranchising us politically. How do we move forward? How do we use Velvet Rage to put in a Democrat into the White House?
I think that schism you describe is there, but it doesn't have to be. I think there's room for all of these different perspectives and experiences. We don't have to go to war or go to battle about the things that divide us. And here's the difference between the left and the right. On the right, they'll argue and they'll debate and they'll even hate their candidate who's a rapist, and they'll vote for him anyway, because when push comes to shove, they're all going to fall in line and vote accordingly. On the left, this is where we get into trouble. I think debate is healthy. I think debate can be really wonderful. But when it comes time to step up and vote, if we are serious about wanting a Democrat in 2020, then we absolutely have to fall in line together and support whomever is the primary candidate. Otherwise, I think we will face exactly the same situation as we did in 2016.
But isn't, but we need debate. Isn't seeing it as left and right a binary that is, you know, also a false paradigm to begin
but
with?
Isn't that the only choice we really have?
Well, when it comes to it, with the dysfunctional system we have today, that seems to be the case. We don't have room for a third. It seems to me anyway, that we don't have room for a third party candidate to really make a serious go at becoming president outside of the two party system. And if they try, they're seriously going to mess things up for one of the parties. And I think we saw that play out in 2016.
Well, when it comes to the Democratic primaries, we have about 12 candidates right now. One as a Trevor Noah says in the Daily Show, you have a Democratic candidate for every calendar month.
Are you going to run Falstow? You're like the only person I know who hasn't announced their candidacy yet. Marianne Williamson's running. Why can't you?
Other things to do, but, you know.
Maybe.
What if it would be like Hillary Clinton? I'm going to investigate.
Well, we do have one former guest of the podcast is running for president. Do you remember from season one of Make Me a Supermodel, Ronnie Kroll? He's been on the podcast a couple of times. He's announced he's running for president. You know, he's just going to bypass Congress, Senate, you know,
school board,
you know, the sheriff, dog catcher, and he's going right for presidency.
As Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, why does everybody, whenever they want to enter a political arena, run for president first?
Well, she said billionaires.
Or billionaires.
Ronnie's not a billionaire, but he's trying to collect enough money to run.
Right. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of candidates who have thrown their hat in the ring who are qualified and very, very wise and do have governmental and law experience. And there's a lot of them. And I think right now where we're at, that's healthy. I think there's room for a lot of candidates to have a very healthy debate. But when it does come time to settling on a single candidate, if we're serious on the left, we've got to stand behind that candidate and support them, even if they're not 100% mirroring what we want. And we understood this when it came to Obama. You know, people forget that Obama was pretty tepid about marriage equality back in 2008. He was not in favor. I mean, many said that he was in favor personally, but politically he couldn't say he was in favor because he couldn't get elected if he said he was in favor. So, but, you know, a lot of gay people were not really enthusiastic about Obama because of his stance on marriage equality, but we fell in line and supported him anyway. And look what happened. He came around and he evolved and supported marriage equality. So I think we really need to do that if we're serious in 2020.
So you're saying you're voting for Bernie? All right, great.
If he was the candidate, sure. I would vote for him if he was the candidate. Okay. He wouldn't be my first choice.
No,
but I would certainly support
Cory Booker if he's the candidate. Let's put it that way. And he's a vegan. And then all of Fox News is like, we're going to have a vegan in the White House? Crazy times, end times. And I'm like, oh, my God.
He seems awfully level-headed. I'm going to make a joke that probably you know, just like you, people will get offended. Now they can be offended by both of us, but he seems awfully humorous.
He's single. There's no way he's going to get, you know, single people don't get
single
vegan, single. No. Sorry.
Well, and he's, I think, on the left, he has earned some distrust and suspicion for various reasons. I like him very much as a candidate, but he wouldn't be my first choice either.
Mm.
And part of it is, like, once this primary gets rolling, we're going to start seeing a lot of propaganda. Even, you know, you're going to see, like, Viacom, MTV, you know, I'm talking about Francesca. She's going to put some video out there about how the front runner of the Democratic Party or how the Democrats are failing, it masked as some other thing, social media garbage. And part of me is like, if you see a video, if you see an article that speaks poorly of the front runner, if you see a article that says both parties are the same or that third party candidates are viable in this election, just go to the about page of the website and find out who is running that website. And chances are you're going to see it's going to be a major media company with ties to big money.
Yeah.
So be very skeptical. If I start telling you that, you know, that both parties are the same, that means that we're We've been bought out. That's how you will know.
You've been bought out by the Chinese investors.
The day I say both parties are the same on this podcast, you will know that I have been compromised.
Okay, but wonderful things, one of the many wonderful things about this show and about the two of you is that you have never gone that direction of being co-opted by any corporation or being told what to say or how to say it.
I put it up for sale and they put me on layaway. I try to sell my soul.
The door is open. Come inside.
I try to sell my soul to the devil and he put it on layaway.
But you do truly, truly embrace the independent spirit that we need. This is a voice we need, especially as we go further into this election cycle. We need independent voices who aren't being controlled by billionaires, by corporations. And you two, for 15 seasons, have really remained that voice of balance, of consideration, of respect and humanity. And that's why I love you guys so much and listen to the show all the time and support the show, because you do such and especially these days now, more than ever, we need your voices out there. So I'm going to keep listening to the show so I know when I'm hearing news that it's really news, or when there's an issue, I'm getting the real story.
I appreciate that so much, Damon L. Jacobs. You're such an inspiring person. You're such a great source of support and emotional kindness in our lives. And I really just really treasure having you on the show every single time you're on.
Thanks, guys. It means a lot. Thank you.
Of course. Hopefully we'll see you soon.
I hope so.
All right.
And we'll turn back time because we believe in something else.
Life after the podcast.
Damon. Thank you, Damon.
Thank you. And if anyone wants to continue this conversation with me, I'm at Damon L. Jacobs. Don't forget the L. DamonLJacobs.com. Or people on Facebook can visit me at Prep Facts, Rethinking HIV Prevention and Sex.
Prep Facts. Get Prep it. Facts.
All right.
Own it. Love it.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you,
Damon.
Damon L. Jacobs lives in New York City. Once again, it's DamonLJacobs.com. Don't forget the L. The L stands for love.
I recommend, you know, if you're a Plus subscriber, go back and listen to some of the other podcasts that we've done with Damon L. Jacobs, or get his book, Absolutely Shouldless. It talks about how we sometimes impose these weird structures of behavior on ourselves when we don't necessarily have to.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Velvet Rage is definitely a great book to check out as well. It definitely feels sometimes like a episode of Good Times where everything's going well and then all of a sudden they get into a car accident, the brakes get hit, and all things go to hell. The three stages are overwhelmed by shame, compensating for shame, and cultivating authenticity. Mm-hmm. And the best way to cultivate authenticity is forgive the past betrayals and enjoy a little bit from the buffet of life, because life is rich and satisfying and has lots to offer. And we need you in this world, baby. We love you, and actively accept your body, all its shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be perfect.
Never is.
It's going to have, or you're going to run into an infection of some kind. You're going to get break an arm.
You're going to get a cyst on your taint.
Yeah.
Anything can happen.
It can, the cyst. You know, I have to say, you know, for Soju talking about her cyst on RuPaul's Drag Race, I think actually was a very healthy thing for queer people's liberation, because that area of our body is kind of like very uncomfortable for us to talk about.
Bottom shame.
Bottom shaming, but also, you know, our taint is like neither our genitals and neither our asshole.
Taint your ass, taint your balls.
And it's a part that we don't feel comfortable talking about. And for her to sort of bring up as this sort of weird branding joke thing actually helped get people talking about their taints some more.
Mm-hmm.
So hats off to Soju.
I love my taint being played with.
Ooh.
Anyway, goodbye, everyone.
Bye. We'll be right back.